This is the Agile Thoughts Podcast, and I'm Lance Kine.
Hi, so I'm Al Shalloway. I'm CEO and owner of Success Engineering, and basically, as far as relevance to y'all listening, I ran Net Objectives for 20 years, where we were a consulting company and did design patterns work, and then I went into the PMI for two, three years, building the discipline Agile Value Stream Consultant, and I'm now at Success Engineering, my own new company.
This is a continuing episode of a series about Al Shalloway's Amplio. So how did you get involved with Agile consulting?
Oh, well, this is an interesting story. So from like 1970 to 96, I was one of these kind of super programmers. I know 10X programmers existed because I was one, and I have metrics to prove it when I worked at IBM. And fortunately, took a workshop in a personal development workshop in the 80s that kind of got me out. Took a while, but it got me out of my arrogance. Do you think I'm arrogant now? You did not want to see me in the 70s or early 80s. And I have met some other 10X programmers that were just incredibly arrogant, because sometimes they are, because they can get so much done.
Right.
So I shifted from writing applications. I built like a dozen different industries, like healthcare, finance. I've written full accounting applications, unique retail sales, used camera gear, stuff like that. I built about a dozen different applications in the 70s and 80s. Hair salons, which was kind of an interesting story as well. But then I decided to move. We were kind of moving from Atlanta to Louisiana. We didn't like, I was there for business reasons, and then moved out to Seattle. And I thought, well, I'll just get back into software development, but I'll consult for a little while because I needed the money. So I got into coaching design people, you know, programmers, teaching people to go from the Fortran mainframe to C++ Windows. And in the process, I learned patterns and I started teaching patterns. So I was very heavy tech. And what started happening, though, is I had a client that I'd done design patterns training. I think I'd done four classes there, so they obviously liked me. And I trained, they had about 200 devs. I trained about 100 of them, which means I should have made a difference. And I remember this guy, it was this conversation that did it. I happened to just come across a woman that had brought me in, or was one of the people. And I'll admit, I asked her this question, hoping for a clap on the back and, oh, Al, you're so wonderful. And I said, well, how's it going? That's not what she didn't give me a pat on the back or a clap. She said, oh, about as bad as ever. And I was like, wow, that's not good. So I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, we just finished a product and they were working with medical equipment. So I was working with the software people, and they had to interact with the medical equipment. And apparently, about 6 months before release, the medical equipment changed the API on some of their equipment. And they had neglected to tell the software people.
Oops.
And then when the shit hit the fan, excuse my language, who got the blame? Well, the software people, of course, because the medical equipment was working and the software stuff wasn't working.
Oh, man.
I mean, I was astounded. But then I realized, I said, it didn't matter. This was around 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, it was more a little later, about 2001, 2002. But it was about that time. It was just around the manifesto had come out. What I realized is it doesn't matter how good you are at programming if you can't work with multiple teams. See, it was great that if they were a software development building just software, but when you work with other teams. And I'd already known Lean from kind of earlier reasons in the 90s, right? I'd studied it in the 80s and I was applying it in the 90s for other reasons, not in software. So then I realized the real problem isn't software development. At least we know how to do this. And I had some people in my company, Net Objectives. I'd written a book, and we were in the process of writing another book, where we knew how to do that. It wasn't being done much, but we knew how to do that. Most people aren't doing it. It's really a shame, because how to write quality code has been known for decades, but very few people are doing it. And again, going back to the manifesto, even though they were trying to say it, somehow people got the idea they can pick and choose what they want. And the answer is no, you cannot violate things. Anyway, so that's when I started getting into teaching Scrum. I'd already been doing XP, but now I started just teaching Agile generically. How do you do project management? Because everybody says, oh, Agile has nothing to do with project management. Go back to Ken Schwaber's book, Agile Project Development, or with Scrum or something. No, it's in the book. It's in, he wrote it. So I started teaching that, and then I got into Kanban, and then it just kind of expanded from there. Because what I've always done is come back from things like Lean originally, because I studied that in the 80s. Then I learned Flow when Don Reinertsen came out with his wonderful book, Principles of Product Development Flow, Second Generation Lean Product Development. There's a clue in that title. Flow is first, Lean is second. They're compatible, but which one's primary? So, and then I had read Goldratt's The Goal in the late 90s. And I'll admit, I misunderstood it. He was so into the manufacturing. And everybody I came across was into it manufacturing. I didn't make the leap into using it as an overarching management of workflow until, oh, I don't know, I guess 10 years ago. And so now I integrate theory constraints in. So I really come from these principles, and then I just pick and choose based on where one is more applicable than the other.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's cool. Because if you can be clear, it's a thinking tool. So if you can be clear on your principles, it helps you explain all the other, like, quote unquote, best practices that people are doing. And this also ties into your conversation about being able to explain why you should do something. If you can't explain why you should do something to your clients, then they would just have to take your word for it. And if they're taking your word for it, maybe under some pressure, they stop doing it because they didn't trust enough. But if it's their own insights, then they're very likely to do it. And it also ties, well, I think it might tie in with, I don't know, the management situation where you said earlier that management is the key point to successful. Somehow they figured it out, I guess.
Well, think about this. So I give an example. I went into one company. This is a company that I think they paid us about $20,000 for 2-day consulting on my time and about 4 days of training their 50 devs in it. And they got a $1.7 million return. They actually said they did more than that, but they were afraid to claim what they really thought because their management would say, well, what were you doing? You know, kind of thing.
Sandbaggers. But,
yeah. So they had to lower the number to believable get us into trouble. But what happened there was and I've written this up as a case study. This is one of those case studies where it was really remarkable. And what had happened was they were working on an old aircraft where it had specialized components on the plane. It was a military aircraft. And there were 7 components, and each one was highly specialized. And they had 7 teams of different sizes between 3 and 10, doing something kind of like Scrum. They had a cadence, but it wasn't really Scrum either. And the problem was they had limited test equipment because they could write the code on their PCs, but they couldn't run it. They had to run it on like what those 7 components. So they had like a plane, they had a simulator, a couple of planes, and then 4 boxes that had all the equipment that they could run. The problem was the planes weren't there in the day because they were being used by pilots to learn by. And the simulator was also often in use. So you had 50 developers sharing 4 test platforms. That's not good. So what happened is people would do a lot of the work. They'd come at night. Oh, I got this thing tonight. They'd come in at 6 at night till the morning. They'd work at night, which isn't good either. But that was not the half of it. If you had something where 2 or 3 components had to interact with each other, if one was wrong, then it would go into the serial musical chair thing of, well, here, this doesn't work. And then they would try it their night 3 days later. And then something that if the 3 of them worked together, you'd figure it out in a matter of hours, would spread out for weeks. Multitasking, frustration. So they brought me in because I knew the guy who was in charge, and he knew I knew Lean. And he knew Lean too, but he thought maybe I could explain it better because I knew how to talk to people, management, like to get it going. And here was the thing about it. So I gave about a day's overview of management and flow to the group, and I can still remember this guy. It's still one of those, I still get goosebumps when I think about this. This guy of one of the teams. Oh, I got to put one other caveat in. My first thought, since I'd learned Kanban, this was a little after using Kanban, I said, well, can we just use Kanban and have it flow between the teams or have cross-functional teams? And he said, no, we don't want cross-functional teams because people like the component they're on. It was too complicated for Kanban to work. So this one guy stood up, and I can still remember word for word what he said. Al, if I believe what you're saying, and I do, then my team needs to slow down, implying to help the other teams. but I don't want to slow down. Now, this took a lot of guts because his manager was in the room and he was saying, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it because I want to do it that way. That afternoon, he said the same thing. He said it again. But toward the end of the day, around 4 o'clock, he says, Al, and it was funny, he said it the same way every time. Al, if I believe you, and I do, my team needs to slow down, and we're going to slow down. And I get goosebumps. It was so brilliant. Yeah. It was, he was making a statement. He was the one who had to give up the most.
Right.
From being the best, the leader of everything, he had to give up being that for the benefit of the group. And it just was a buzz. Everybody got, yeah, we're charged. And basically, I made up a new process that had never been done before. I now call it dynamic mobbing. At the time, I called it dynamic feature teams. It was really simple. It was when you have a big, you do the big things first because they would cause the availability of people, affect the availability of people most, and we wanted to limit delays. And the big things would come in first, and the teams would swarm on those during the day using the test equipment. And then not everybody would have something big. So then they would pull off the backlog, the little things they could do individually. So about 20% of the work people would now swarm on. I call it dynamic mobbing now because there's mobbing, you know. But back then I just called it a dynamic feature team because they would come together. Now, this is what's interesting about this. It violated every practice I knew at the time. You don't do this crap. You keep teams together. You do this, right. You do that. But I knew it followed principles, and I didn't care that it violated practices. When principles are in, when it's like the evidence and theory. You go with the evidence. You don't go with the theory. The evidence is in this case, so it's you go with the validated theory, the verifiable theory, instead of, well, this is how we like to do it or what's in the Scrum Guide. And it was an instant hit. I mean, we showed them how to do how to work Scrum with this on top of it. So it wasn't Scrum, but they did. They had monthly cycle. I think it was monthly sprints at the time. And they just picked it up like that. And see, now this is another interesting side point that I don't think I've written in the case study, but I might need to. Getting people to do things like Scrum or whatever is often difficult because they wonder why. We want to do it the way we want to do it. And, you know, like, why should everybody be in a 2-week cadence? Well, when people see the big picture and they understand the big picture, they say, oh, okay, so maybe this isn't ideal for me, but it's ideal for us. So when you look at it the right way, you can create us. In fact, one of the other of the four case studies, I remember in the middle of the talk, I was there. This is the case study where they had troubles integrating. I think the first one I mentioned is case study one. The second one, if you read it, is case study two. Is the guy said, oh, you're creating a bigger team. I taught him how to align three teams working from the same backlog. Alignment is so much better than coordination. We had discovered scrums, which is a coordinating technique, doesn't work as well as alignment, where everybody's working on the same thing. So this kind of stuff is really, I won't say it's common sense because it's not used much, so it's certainly not common.
Right.
But it fits reality. That's what we need. We need a term. Oh, yeah, that fits reality sense.
Agile Grande teaches you systems thinking through dramatic storytelling, such as Carter takes a job to improve a logistics company's adaptability, but efforts to scale agile practices are being blocked by Mr. Chernesky, a vice president who's organized the company into siloed pigeonholes in order to secretly make millions with a dark web shipping service. Carter's life is in danger. He goes underground, and a spy agency hunts for him. When Carter uses systems thinking, systems modeling, and organizational change to save his company and his life, you get to learn how to apply that to your organization as well. Get your free copy of Agile Grande at leanpub.com. Check out the show notes. They have links back to useful things about Amplio and other things that Al Shalloway has been up to. What are show notes? Show notes shoot right into your podcast player for your easy access every time you load a podcast show like this one. But if you're using a web browser and downloading the MP3s, go back to the page that you downloaded the MP3 from, and there you will see the show notes. The series started at episode 281. You can find that episode by going to agilethoughts.info and type into the search box the episode number you missed. Next episode, more Al Shalloway.
But then I started realizing you can't separate what you do from how you talk to people about how to do it. Yet that's what's happening in the Agile space. You know, you have coaching workshops. You have Scrum Master workshops, which are actually more about Scrum than they are about how to actually coach. This is one of the reasons we're having problems. All these Scrum Masters know Scrum, but they don't know how to talk to people. They don't know how to convey. They don't know how to talk to management.